Thank you for coming. My topic today is scientific causality in classical theism. Now, as you can see on the slideshow, by classical theism, I mean the understanding of God as the metaphysically ultimate being. That is, he's the ultimate and highest reality and explanation of everything else without himself needing an explanation or cause. And he can be said to have various divine attributes when God as a whole is looked at from different points of view, such as all-powerful, all-knowing, completely good, simple without parts, immutable, thus most dynamic and relational, necessary, infinite, and eternal, among many other attributes. Classical theism is rooted within the perennial philosophical tradition of ancient Greek philosophers such as Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and was brought to a greater degree of perfection by Christian thinkers, including many of the church fathers such as Saint Athanasius, and medieval church doctors such as Saint Augustine, Anselm, and Saint Thomas Aquinas, and medieval Muslim thinkers such as Averroes and Avicenna, and Jewish thinkers such as Maimonides. In many ways, classical theism is the historical orthodoxy of our Christian faith when it comes to understanding God and his relationship with the world through philosophical theology, which integrates natural theology, divine revelation, and our Christ-centered philosophical and theological reflection understanding of it. Now, classical theism's understanding of the relationship between God and humans can be summed up with verses from the Apostle Paul. He says, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands, ... For in him we live and live and move and have our being." This is from Acts 17:24-28. It is noteworthy that Paul quotes from the Christian philosopher Epimenides to explain our relation with God. He says, "In him we live and move and have our being," in God. From the standpoint of Christian tradition, what Paul illuminates here is what later develops into a Christian classical theistic doctrine called the doctrine of divine conservation. And as Edward Fraser points out in his article, Existential Inertia and the Five Ways. Go. PowerPoint slideshow. What the doctrine of divine conservation, or DDC for short, essentially holds is that God not only has created all things, but also conserves them or keeps them in existence. And without God's divine conserving power, things would cease to exist. However, the implication of divine conservation, in fact, does not simply stop at a level of mere conservation, because that would threaten to collapse into deism, but goes further to affirm also the doctrine of divine concurrence, which argues that God also maintains the causal efficiency of things. That is, he allows and supports his creations to exercise the causal powers that they have from their own being. From the perspective of Christian philosophical theology, and it's, for me, the strongest proponent, Scholasticism, or Aristotelian Thomism, it is important that we uphold these two doctrines, among many others, because they affirm the biblical truth that in God we live and move and have our being. The importance of this statement is that we live and act freely under the conservation and concurrence of God, and God cannot be collapsed or mushed into his creation. God is both transcendent and immanent. He is the transcendent author and creator of all reality, and he is at the same time also the immanent and personal source and sustainer of all reality. And if we break away from this classical theistic understanding of God, his relation with us, and causality, which I think unfortunately did happen in modernity under the paradigm of modern mechanistic philosophy, we often run into problematic theological as well as philosophical positions, such as occasionalism, pantheism, and deism, and etc. At this point, it is perhaps helpful to put all the above remarks into the traditional philosophical and theological language of Aristotelian scholasticism. Aristotle, in his Physics, argues, contrary to the thoughts of Parmenides and Heraclitus, that reality is in neither absolute stasis nor in absolute flux, but exhibits both stability and dynamism because there's a distinction between potentiality and actuality. Slideshow. Where change is properly understood as the actualization of potentials. For example, when we take ice out of the freezer, it melts. And this is because of the actuality of heat energy. It's actualizing the water's potencies to exist in a liquid way. So we're actualizing the potencies of water molecules in ice to move faster, making them able to break the hydrogen bonds between molecules in order to form liquid water. And as contemporary Aristotelian Catholic thinker David Olderberg points out in his really awesome book, Real Essentialism, that from an Aristotelian perspective, substances in physical reality exhibit certain potentials or potencies by virtue of having certain actualities. That is, their own unique modes or forms of being from which they attain their relatively stable patterns, properties, characteristics, and potentials, so on and so forth. Therefore, for Aristotle and the later scholastic thinkers such as Aquinas and Scotus and Strabus, change does not in fact require being arising from non-being, which is the thought of Parmenides, but the reduction from being in potency to being in act or actuality. Thus, Aristotle was able to point out the middle course between the extreme positions of Parmenides, nothing change, and Heraclitus, nothing, there's nothing but change, Heraclitus, by making the distinction between act and potency and explain the relation, such as potency is rooted within actuality, and actuality can actualize potencies, etc. Now, from the foundation of act and potency, Aristotelian Thomism further develops the doctrine of holomorphism, which argues that substances are composites of both form and matter. Specifically, from an Aristotelian Thomistic or AT perspective for short, the notion of matter or material cause, as pointed out by Thomas thinker William Wallace, is best expressed as mass or potential energy, since matter is really the result of certain potencies taking on certain forms and exist as something concrete rather than abstract, whereas form or formal causes or substantial forms are the actualities or energizing fields, to use Wallace's example, his language in his awesome book, The Modeling of Nature, Philosophy of Nature and Philosophy of Science in Synthesis. These energizing fields that actualize certain matters and potencies to form complete substances in reality. Hence, from an AT perspective, things in reality exhibit material cause, but especially they're real, that is to say, their built-in or immanent being as their formal cause, or natures, or essences, or substantial forms. Hence, the significance of this is that the finite creations of God are thus real and true in their existence, rather than mere epiphenomena of something else. At this point, an important message arises. Since substances exhibit their immanent or built-in being or nature, they also exhibit causal powers and immanent, inherent, final causes or teleology or goal-directedness or telos. For a scholastic thinker, causal power is the power that moves something from potential to actual. Hence, in Aristotelian Thomism, the concept of causal power and causality and causation are really intimately related with the concept of final cause, because the immanent telos or final cause of substance is to exist and operate as what it is, given its formal cause or nature, or its being, which includes actualizing the potencies that it attains from its nature and exhibiting certain characteristics, patterns, properties, and causal powers in its own existence, as well as in interaction with other things. For example, magnesium. This is as scientific as I can get as a philosopher. Magnesium, by virtue of its actuality, being or nature or form, usually looks silver or white color and can burn when it reacts with oxygen and produces bright light. Electrons, by virtue of their built-in being, form, or essence, always exhibit negative charges and will not suddenly have positive charges next week after the conference is done. These sort of phenomena, that is, for substances to have certain relatively regular and predictable characteristics, patterns, properties, and effects that natural science can discover, occur because substances exist and operate as what they are, which is their immanent teleology or final cause that follows from their relatively stable forms or modes of being. The classical Latin expression for this linkage between what things are, formal cause, and how they exist or operate, final cause or teleology, is to use Aquinas' phrase in the Summa Contra Gentiles, agere sequitur esse, meaning actions follow from being, or the activities of things follow from their modes of existence. Now, the standard modern philosophical rejection of these traditional and classical Aristotelian Thomistic metaphysical notions often takes the mask of science. For example, can we not abandon what seems like ancient notions such as formal cause or nature and simply regard substances in reality as no more than some of their parts, such as atom molecules? You can imagine Hume saying that right now, right? That can be manipulated with scientific means. In fact, rejections of this sort are unscientific if they really understand science. To clarify, David Oderberg, again, points out in his book, Real Essentialism, that substances are not reducible to their chemical compositions or parts. For example, since there are hydrogen atoms in water, we should be able to burn it, but in fact, we cannot. And since water contains oxygen, it should boil at negative 180 degrees, but in fact, water boils at positive 100 degrees, at least at the ground level. In other words, water as a substance has its own nature and new actuality and causal powers that are irreducible to its parts. Modern physics, I think, from what little I know about science, modern physics calls this phenomenon emergence, which is related to what the Aristotelian Thomists termed substantial change, where the actualization of potentials taking place within the interaction between different substances, resulting in the emergence of new or diminish of some old substances. Therefore, metaphysical notions such as formal cause, substantial form, nature, or essences are in fact indispensable for a more complete understanding of reality, which requires not only science, that is not to say science is not important, I'm all for science, I love my air conditioning, which explains how questions, but also philosophy, especially as Aristotle taught us, the first philosophy, metaphysics, is not epistemology, which explains why questions. The same goes for final cause or teleology. That was meant to be a joke, actually, not epistemology. It is commonly supposed by modern thinkers, such as Spinoza, that telos for Aristotle and Aquinas refer to some static, unknowable, and unchanging external cause or fate that draws things to work towards them, and they argue how such an understanding of reality cancels out modern science. However, from what we've already talked about regarding teleology, it is clear that modern philosophers have seriously misunderstood and misinterpreted what teleology really is. And its true definition is for substances to exist and function as what they are, resulting in them having certain characteristics, properties, the ability to generate certain effects, having certain causal powers, etc. Thus, Aristotelian scholastic metaphysics, especially its teleological view of the world, does not in fact block modern science, but is in fact what science ontologically presupposes. There's something special about Aristotelian Thomism because, as the great Dominican philosopher Benedict Ashley argues, Aristotelian school is one of the few metaphysical theories that realizes that although metaphysics is something that scientifically, ontologically presupposes, science is something that's presupposed epistemologically by metaphysics. I don't think you find that very often among other schools. So, in fact, that in order to predict and control the workings of the universe, right, the fact we can do these things presupposes that they have relatively stable being or formal causes, and that we can make use of things' causal powers and properties presupposes that they exhibit immanent teleology to exist and function as what they are. Hence, for scholasticism or Aristotelian Thomism, found within our great Christian tradition, substances in reality exhibit real being and causal powers, and at the same time require the divine conserving and concurring power of God. Thus, we as God's creations are nonetheless free to act in God's providence as ourselves, and thus have the moral responsibility for how we practice our causal powers in our relation with God, each other, and the world, according to Christ's teachings. Love yourself as you love your neighbors, love God. However, this Christian view, you might say this orthodox or classical Christian view, is very much undermined by a movement within modernity called mechanistic philosophy. There we go. hope that picture is not too disturbing. That's the mildest one I can find, which was held to different degrees by almost all the major early modern philosophers, including Francis Bacon, René Descartes, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, David Hume, and Immanuel Kant. Mechanistic, and among many others, the list goes on. Mechanistic philosophy in general argues that physical substances in reality have no built-in natures or intrinsic properties and causal powers, and the fact that there are cause and effect relations in reality is just the result of some externally imposed laws which manipulate things in reality that are otherwise inert, that is, without causal power. Such a mechanistic understanding of the world was designed to eliminate metaphysical notions such as formal and final causes, which were unfortunately abused by many authorities, since but also because we cannot control and manipulate them. On the contrary, Aristotelian Thomism, when it is correctly understood, as Oderberg and Fieser would point out, that the so-called scientific laws of nature are really our shorthand, although useful description for how things actually operate given their natures and causal powers. But these descriptions as abstractions are not reality itself, which is the difference between science and scientism. Right? And this is the mistake of modern mechanistic philosophy, he confused between the two. The real serious consequence of early modern mechanistic philosophy, though, besides being scientifically outdated in light of contemporary science, especially quantum mechanics, is that it takes away causal power from substances in reality. Thus, a question confronted the early modern thinkers. If causal power is not at least in things themselves in part, where does it come from? And how do we then explain motion and change in reality? In other words, we're back to Parmenides and Heraclitus. Modern philosophy divided itself into several camps over this problem. And one of the bigger camps is called, as Fieser points out, occasionalism. I have a definition there, which is a theory that if causal power and teleology do not exist in things themselves and partially in God, partially in things and partially in God, since God is the sustainer, as in classical theism and scholasticism, they must exist all in God. For example, when a criminal murders another man, he cannot really be held accountable based on occasionalism because he has no causal power. Right? But it is God who literally murdered that man. Thus, God and the world become hard to differentiate. And as a result, God collapses into his creation and becomes the world itself. And this position leads us to an even more problematic theological position called pantheism, in which God is literally the world. And as Fieser points out, the tendency of, in his book, Neo-Scholastic Essays, one of the essays, in which he points out that the tendency of occasionalism can be found within Descartes and Malebranche, and the tendency of pantheism can be found in Spinoza, among many other thinkers. The opposite of pantheism is deism, which asserts that God has only created the world and then left the building, become distant from it without interaction. Now, from the point of view of the Christian tradition, both pantheism and deism cannot account for the biblical truth that in God we live and move and have our being. Since in occasionalism and pantheism, there is no we, since God is the only one who is ever doing everything. And in deism, there is no God, since he is so fundamentally separated from us. However, as we just discussed, Christian classical theism, with its doctrine of conservation and concurrence, proved itself to be an enduring legacy from the ancient world. It is the virtuous middle course between the extreme positions of pantheism and deism and Parmenides and Heraclitus, because since God is indeed the transcendent creator, pantheism is avoided. And since God is also the personal and immanent sustainer who keeps things in existence and their causal efficiency, deism is avoided. Also, classical theism is rooted and supported by the classical Western metaphysical tradition, including especially Aristotelian Thomism. But this great tradition has been kept away from many of us because of the influence of early modern mechanistic philosophy in the name of modern science. However, contemporary science has long advanced and moved on from the early modern conception of science, and one of the key pioneers of quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, famously argues that we in fact need the Aristotelian concept of potency and act in order to adequately understand the implications of atomic events in his book, Physics and Philosophy. And Fieser also points out there's a great renewal in the interest of scholasticism or AT philosophy in the contemporary discussion of philosophy of science brought up by thinkers such as Nancy Cartwright and many other thinkers. I think this Aristotelian scholastic renewal is very much beneficial to our Christian faith and philosophical theology insofar as it helps us to retrieve the underlying traditional Christian philosophical heritage in which classical theism is properly rooted. Thank you.
All right, Marcus kept himself very much in time, and so
we have a
chance for a number of questions.
Go ahead.
Sometimes I've heard the idea that the laws of nature are sort of God's usual way of acting, something like that, so that a miracle would be some sort of departure from his usual habits. That always sounded kind of vocationalist to me, and sort of not sufficiently accounted for the what you call a concurrence.
That's right.
I don't know if you feel the same way about that.
Yeah, definitely. There are two notions of laws of nature in philosophy. One is the, you might say, the classical conception of laws of nature brought up by Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas. And then there's the Humean, or the modern mechanistic understanding of the laws of nature. Right? In the latter case, there are no built-in beings to things. They are just simply manipulated by these externally. They'll conserve the laws that come out of nowhere, just manipulating like a puppet. So these laws are held to be something ontologically, right? Ontologically true, implicitly. Whereas in the classical understanding of natural law, these laws are really our way of describing how things operate, given their innate nature conserved and concurred by God. So that's the difference.
Yeah. Okay.
And that is why miracle is really not a violation of laws of nature, if Hume really understood what he wanted to commit
right,
to the flame.
Right. It's an interaction.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. We should commit Hume to the flame. Figuratively.
Other questions? Go ahead.
I'm interested in concrete examples because it gets
yes.
I'm not a philosopher, so like bear with me, right? And it's helpful to kind of work through some of these questions. And one example that might be useful at the time, contrary to Descartes, we had Pascal.
That's right.
If I think, if I understood your point well enough, that Pascal, when he studied the vacuum, might give us some famous experiments and ways of brewing.
He's interesting.
In contrast to some of his, say, scholastic colleagues who I think would exemplify what you described as kind of misappropriation of the classical tradition. So that we understand the vacuum, basically by demonstrating the vacuum, he was not so much contrasting with the classical tradition as much as maybe drawing upon the intrinsic properties of atmosphere, of mercury. So the way the vacuum studies work, right, it was taking a mercury and inverting it in a tube and measuring the height, right? Mm-hmm. So atmospheric pressure measure is what we think about it today. If I understand your point, then the Pascal's strategy, his empirical strategy, was completely congruent with what I think you're offering for us as a classical tradition. Am I catching you right, or am I misunderstanding something?
No, Pascal is a really interesting thinker.
Yes.
He is kind of a mysterious and obscure thinker to me. It is hard for me to, at this point, understand what he is really arguing about.
Okay.
Right, partially because of his writing style,
yes.
And partially because of just how he conflicted his. Right, I like him. That he took a stand against someone like Descartes, and he himself, as I remember, was pretty heavily influenced by St. Augustine.
Yes.
So right. I think there's definitely back and forth in his thought, but I think I need to read him more so before I can say for sure that
aside from accounting for his thought, we have the concrete. That's why I go concrete.
Right. Okay. Oh, okay. I see.
Right? I'm not asking you to systematize.
Okay.
Pascal. I'm asking you. We've got a concrete experiment.
Mm.
We've demonstrated the atmospheric pressure by taking the mercury and undoing it. So from your analysis, your classical theistic stance, right? We're talking about concurrence. We're talking about conservation as principles.
That's right.
The intrinsic then to the activity. So that's why the concrete examples allow
that
us.
That sounds right to me.
That would fit, I think.
Yeah, I think this, from what I've heard, right,
yeah,
there are intrinsic power these two things,
yes,
and they're responsible for how things operate.
Yes.
Well, that's against the mechanistic extent that things are causally invariant. Right? That much, I think.
Yeah,
that's
but
right.
It sounds congruent.
Yeah,
right.
It does
okay.
sound congruent. Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Anyone else?
Yes, Chris Morgan. Yeah.
How would you respond to critics of what you call the ET philosophy, this Aristotelian metaphysics, which comes with the whole scholastic apparatus of concepts and obscure terminology? So, for example, substantial form. What if people say, why do you want to drag Aristotelian ideas into a modern scientific context? Does it really illuminate what's going on? Isn't Aristotle obsolete? Don't we need to develop something new rather than revive this tradition that died justly so that we could have modern science? I mean, why do we need substantial form? I think you already know my thoughts on this, right?
That's
I just
right.
see it as substantial.
I know you agree with me.
Dynamic concept. It's not a static, platonic notion, but I'd like to hear more about how you
that's
respond
right.
to people who bristle at your suggestion that
yeah.
we need more Aristotle.
Yeah, that's right.
Quick response. A quick response.
Okay, yeah. And my experience has been that people often overgeneralize Aristotle. Says, oh, he's obsolete. Now, what many contemporary Aristotelian thinkers, such as Olderberg, Fazer, and me, we would say, you have to make a careful distinction because Aristotle left such a massive legacy. Now, some of his, in which some of the elements are, you might say, concerning with natural science, which are indeed outdated in light of contemporary science. But that's not all Aristotle does. He also does philosophy and metaphysics. Whilst his empirical examples and observations may be obsolete, his philosophical principles, metaphysical principles, are nonetheless authentic. For example, you know, stars may be fixed, you know, sun may be the, you know, may center, earth may center. Aristotle wouldn't really be really bothered by that. He would say that no matter how they operate, well, they do that given their nature and how they interact with other things. So on that point, I don't think Aristotle is really obsolete. He's even someone that's more than defensible in the atmosphere of contemporary science.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.